spring day in the middle of winter. We're going to begin by opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 10,002. Ask Dana Bauer to come forward, and thank you for holding over from Tuesday. I'm sure you found all that testimony the other day just absolutely wonderful.
Good. Good afternoon, Chair Metzger and members of the committee. I'm Dana Bauer. Last name is B-A-U-G-H-E-R.
Yeah, I know that. I should know that.
I've brought a good bill to you today. Good for the contractors and good for the consumers. In 2002, I talked to several painting contractors about painting the exterior of my home, and the one I chose presented a proposal in writing with his signature on it. I spoke with him on the phone to say I'd chosen his company to do the job with a few additions, including changing the flat paint to semi-gloss and sanding as well as scraping and priming. And on a day not prearranged and after I'd gone to work for the day, the painter came onto my property and applied paint over a cracked and lifted surface on the entire west end of my house. I think you have pictures of it. I did not have a signed contract, as I mistakenly presumed I should have had. I thought that the proposal that was presented to me with his signature on it would also need my signature on it. But that wasn't the case. Long story short, 12 days later, the job was still less than satisfactory. The instructions on the paint can and the internet specifically indicated sanding the surface was required prior to applying the paint. Not to comply with the instructions would void the manufacturer's warranty. This was one addition to the contract that I had wanted to discuss prior to the actual painting. Several problems were obvious when the painter determined he had completed the job, including holidaying, no evidence of back brushing, unpainted surfaces in many places, streaking, and paint applied over a rough surface. I contacted the CCB, the Construction Contractors Board, and they concurred that 13 problems needed to be corrected. Upon completion of 8 problems, the contractor pulled his painter from the job and walked away, and the CCB arbitrarily closed the claim. I had gone to an attorney prior to going to the CCB to talk to him about what my alternatives were for having a good job done in my house, which is, of course, like your houses, probably the biggest investments you'll ever make. The attorney was $175 an hour, and for my case at $2480, it wasn't worth hiring him, so he suggested going to the CCB. I got my crash course in contractor law from him, Contractor Law 101. The attorney told me that at $2,500, you have a contract. At $2,480, you don't. And the bid on my house was $2,480. $20 less than what you need to have a contract. Lowering the contract price, for which there must be a signed contract, to $2,000 will provide most homeowners with the security of having a document by which they can hold a contractor responsible. Most homes can't be painted under $2,000. No painter could have come on my property, proceeded with the work based on a telephone call, unless there were a written contract signed by both the contractor and the homeowner. My home is my biggest investment. When I have work done to preserve my biggest investment, I hope to get the best deal for my money, and $2,500 is no small sum for me. If this contractor had not been able to do the additional work that I wanted, he may not have been awarded the job. Instead, many unnecessary problems developed. Both parties were inconvenienced beyond reasonable. I have the support of Senators Westland, Schrader, Pazansky, Representative Hunt, and I'd be pleased to have your support as well to send out Senate Bill 1002. It's a win-win.
Okay. Thank you, Dana.
Thank you.
So, members, what we have here is... she has testified is would be simply changing the limitation from $2,500 to $2,000 for having a contract that is written, and we heard her story about that had her contract had this been a $2,000 limitation, she would have had a written contract. And if there's any, are there any questions?
Yes,
Senator Monica.
I just want to understand this. I didn't realize that. So if I wanted to do repairs and the cost would be more than $2,500, a contract is required?
I don't know that it's required, but I would have had one. I would have had one in my case. I thought the proposal that I had was a contract.
Oh, you had something in writing?
Yes, I had this full document in writing.
Okay.
And I called him and asked him if I could change things, and he said, oh, definitely, certainly. But the things were not changed before the painting project began, and then after it had begun, it was not being looked at.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah, other questions? Senator Starr.
I don't necessarily have a question to Dana, but a question. Is there anybody from the contractors board here? Construction contractors board? I thought so.
Well, come on forward, please. Yeah, please identify yourself.
Hi, Dana.
Chair Metzger, members of the committee, my name is Craig Smith. I'm administrator of the Construction Contractors Board.
Okay, I think Senator Starr has a question.
The issues about contracts, my understanding is that a verbal contract, I mean, the law says you're supposed to have things in writing at a certain level, but you can verbally enter into a contract that is as equally binding as anything that's written on paper. Isn't that the case? And might you just kind of explain a little bit of the history and background behind why it is that this is currently in statute?
Chair Metzger and Senator Starr, first I want to make it clear that I'm not a lawyer, and we're talking about some legal principles, but the general answer to your question is yes. A contract is not a written document. A contract is an agreement. The elements of a contract include an offer, an acceptance, and consideration. The problem with an oral contract, and this is the thing that we end up having problems with all the time, is the parties don't agree. And one person has in their mind a certain result, and another party has a different result. And so although you can have a binding contract, it's more difficult to have a meeting of the minds. And when problems happen, the fact that you don't have a written contract with both parties' signature attesting to what is going to be done under the terms of the contract, therein lies the problem. So a while back, the statute was changed so that a licensed construction contractor is obligated to have a written contract if the contract price is over $2,500.
And
I guess the question is, what's magic about $2,500, or what's magic about $2,000, or why not $1,500? Or, I mean, could not the same situation that we've heard about today occur? You know, if it's at $1,500, somebody comes in with a bid at $1,450 or $1,475. Is there something magic about the number?
Chair Metzger and Senator Starr, I think the premise of your question is on target, and that is there isn't anything particular magic. In the handout that I've given you today, if I could draw your attention to page 3, what I've done on that page is put a chart and shown all of the disputes that we resolved during last biennium broken out by certain contract amounts. And in the middle, it was supposed to be shaded, shows the contract amounts between $2,000 and $2,500. And you can see that we received about 300 complaints for that amount of contract in that range. And we awarded damages of about $300,000 there. This is really a policy issue. The line needs to be drawn somewhere. Where you've driven, where you have put the line today is $2,500. The question is, do you want to move it?
Okay. Other questions? Okay. Thank you. Anyone else fit to testify? What be the pleasure of the committee?
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
We don't have any testimony from the contractors' representatives that prowl the halls of the building?
No. We had no one sign up at the original hearing on Tuesday or today.
Interesting.
Yes, please.
If I could make one point, I'm a little concerned, and so is our counsel, regarding the voidability provision in the contract. And the last page, page 6, mm-hmm. In my handout, is a memo from our Assistant Attorney General that points out that you have in this particular bill, you have a pretty stiff sanction if a party enters into a contract and doesn't put it into writing. It's able to be voided. So as she analyzes the case, you could have a $10,000 improvement. The work could be done absolutely correctly. And if the consumer chose not to want to make the payment, it would legally be possible to do so if the law was changed like this. So I think you want to think about that provision seriously. And I have talked to other members of the construction industry, and they're somewhat concerned about it. Mm-hmm. From a regulatory standpoint, it would be a heck of a motivator. So I'll leave that with you. But from a practical world standpoint, you may want to give that strong consideration.
And I totally agree. And that language came out of Velsey, and it came out on the last day before we were really, really able to review the bill and change it before it went to print. So I totally agree.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
I want to say, Senator Starr, are you finished? I'm
well, and I had a train of thought and then got interrupted with this discussion as I started thinking about this. So let me see if I can remember where I was.
Senator Monis Anderson.
Yeah. You said that the board isn't opposing it. A proponent or oppose it. I think that's what you said in here, but because you would address this at your March 29th meeting? Is that?
Chair Metzger and Senator Monis Anderson, that's correct.
I remember, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Starr.
You, in your handout, you say you had 362 claims in the 2,000 to 2,500 range. That has to, you know, adjudicating those claims have to cost to something. Do we anticipate a fiscal impact in this bill, and what might that be? And my guess is that those are other funds, and that's a contractor's fund your agency, but could you just give us a
lot of questions
there?
Chair Metzger and Senator Starr, the answer to the question is we don't anticipate a fiscal impact statement. We were asked by LFO to consider that. I don't think that this bill would lower or raise the amount of claims that we'd receive. It's possible it could raise it, particularly if we... But let me just say, I don't think that we have fiscal impact. And all of the funds to resolve these disputes, and the average cost to resolve a dispute is around $600. It's expensive. But that is all paid by contractor licensing fees. Today, consumers do pay a $50 processing fee, but if they prevail in the hearing, that $50 is returned to them by the contractor.
Any other questions? Okay, I think what we'll do, since we have one issue in the bill that the parties agree to, that we will take care of amending that out. Dana, what I would ask you to do is just check with the members about that, and then we will consider bringing this back next week amended for a work session, if that's amenable to you. Okay, great. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1002. And now, ladies and gentlemen, we are going to open up a work session for Senator Atkinson. So I'm going to let him get down there. Public hearing, rather. And we're going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bills 514 and... Senator, should we, you want to talk about these together or separate? Okay, so we'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 514 and Senate Bill 554. And welcome Senator Atkinson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and a personal note of thanks not only for the hearing, but for allowing the hearing to be here today rather than Hood River. I've been working on this issue for some time, and there's been a group of us, and even though this was posted this week, we really tried to get as many people as we could here today. I'm very flattered that Dan Leahy has driven over from Central Oregon this morning to be here. I know a few others were trying to get here, and several people have sent me emails. Let me speak first to the committee in general terms about this issue and about these two bills. Both of these bills get at the same issue that's before you. But let me give you maybe a 30,000-foot perspective of this crisis, and then Mr. Leahy can speak, and we can go from there. Oftentimes in this building, colleagues, you know that speeches are made that if we don't do something now, jobs are going to be lost, businesses are going to go out of business, local communities' economies are going to be hurt, or the entire state's economy is going to be hurt. And oftentimes that's a political speech that's used to sway people's opinion one way or the other. This is a case in which this is actually happening, where businesses are being lost, small economies are being greatly damaged, all because of a false requirement that the state of Oregon puts on construction contractors to have a certain level of business that really makes them uncompetitive, not only in Oregon, but also in other states. We do this, colleagues, under the guise of consumer protection, because we've always believed, thank you very much. Thanks. The final last piece of my testimony just arrived. We believe that if we call it consumer protection, politicians can go home safe because they've protected the consumer, and Oregonians are going to be better off, so we can stick it to business and protect taxpayers from whatever. So that's how this whole thing gets started. So in Oregon right now, we have $500,000 insurance requirement under the guise of consumer protection that we place on small contractors. Everyone has got to have this. It's a force mandate. You've got to, if you want to do business in Oregon, it has to have $500,000 consumer protection liability coverage. The state of Washington, their premium is $250,000. The state of California doesn't have a set premium. In fact, I think Craig Smith could tell you, very few states actually have an insurance premium requirement. Ours is, of the few states that do have it, ours is significantly high. So what we have learned, though, is that insurance companies are making a lot of money, especially in the wake of 9/11, off of our own small businesses through exorbitant rates that they have to pay if they want to stay in business. Craig Smith, I hope, Mr. Chair, that you would call him up. He has completed a survey. I have a draft of it. But the survey of contractors in the state of Oregon, seeing if they're actually getting something for the high premiums that they're paying, and in turn, if the public is actually protected or not, and what has actually happened. I think he can detail for you the best that they have seen insurance premiums raise from 33% to 160%. In real terms, I have a small contractor in my district who has got a truck and some tools. He's a subcontractor. He saw his insurance premium raise from $3,000 annually to $12,000. $12,000 for more insurance coverage when he gets absolutely nothing more for that coverage. That's $12,000 is the difference of that contractor either being profitable or not profitable. That's a huge chunk of money for a small contractor. So I have a large contractor in my district that saw their premium go from $33,000 a year to $160,000 a year for less coverage. That, to me, is criminal. But that's what we're doing. I can show you in my district four businesses that have gone out of business and moved to Arizona and moved to the Bay Area. I live obviously on the border between California and Oregon, and it's easier for them to go to California to start up, to compete, even in all the other regulation that they've got, simply because they can't compete in Oregon any longer. Senator Starr will tell you, being a roofer, how absolutely obnoxious these insurance rates are for no coverage. Insurance companies will come up here and they'll tell you, well, it's because of 9/11. Well, you know what? Other states around us who don't have this problem are able to compete. So I really don't think Oregonians are being protected when we're wiping out a whole section of the middle of our economy. Now, that's what I said in my opening remarks, Mr. Chairman, that whole sections of our economy and small businesses are being hurt. In my district, one of the major employment factors for me is contractors, all the way from engineering contractors down to plumbers, siding, roofing, drywall. It's a huge chunk of the middle of my economy. If you look at healthcare, you look at contracting. If you look at schools, you look at contracting. If you look at double income families, you look at contracting. And every one of them who are involved in this industry have to pay these exorbitant fees. I just think what these two bills seek to do is do two things. One is to allow larger contractors to self-insure if they choose to do that. And two, the other one is to get rid of the insurance requirement altogether, or greatly lower it. I would like to see it get rid of it altogether. I think that would actually be the best thing to do for business. But what we hope to do is get this, bring this to your attention. Larger contractors, you might say, well, how come nothing's happened already? Well, let me go ahead and offend everyone in the room by telling you that some larger contractors can use this as a barrier of entry so that smaller contractors can't compete. Larger contractors can say, I can afford this huge insurance premium and tough if you can't. Now, I'm all for the free market system. In business, you got to compete if you want to survive. I believe that. But I don't believe the state of Oregon is doing anyone any favors by putting this bar up there that says you got to pay this much if you want to play. And by the way, the insurance isn't really going to cover you if you need coverage. Let me go ahead and read you a couple of emails, because I've told you about insurance or companies that I've lost, and these are real people. Many of them I've collected are from the districts of the members of this committee. Let me read from them, and then I'll answer any questions and send it to Mr. Leahy. This comes from State in Oregon. I personally prefer to have liability insurance at the prices and demands mandated by the insurance company are forcing me to raise my rates or consider relocating my business to another state that won't require me to buy this insurance if I consider it to be unreasonable. The insurance companies raise the rates and create ridiculous requirements, and contractors have no choice if they want to continue contracting. So people have the option to say no thanks. If they had that option, perhaps insurance rates would not be so high. I'll skip that next paragraph, but he says, most of all, if the insurance companies located in other states are resulting in massive amounts of insurance premiums, which are taking money out of Oregon's economy. Staten. This from the president of a company in Portland, Oregon. Contractors and the public are being ripped off big time. Here's my story, and I'll abbreviate it. 2 years ago, my company was canceled after nearly 14 years with State Farm. $1 million in liability coverage for my small remodel business cost around $1,500 a year based on $1.2 million in annual gross revenue. I was told that because of 9/11 and EFIS claims and lawsuits, they were canceling all contracts that had subwork out, not just State Farm. Most standard carriers canceled remodeling or general contractors. In 2003, my insurance cost was over $4,400, and my business dropped down to only $400,000 in revenue. In 2004, the premium went up to over $500. Now the company that was insurance has been canceled. My agent has placed us with a new company and states that I should be thankful. The new rate now is $6,200 for what? He tells me that if I build one custom home, my premium will jump to a base rate of $20,000 to $25,000 from $1,500. So I ask you, committee members, for what? Why? Tell me one Oregonian that's being protected from this insurance rate. I'll go on. This from Portland again. He urging me to debunk the myths about consumer protection and the level playing field. I think I've already done that. I'll read one more to you. The CCB has documented hundreds, if not thousands, of responses from contractors whose liability insurance premiums have increased 10, 40, 80, or even 100-fold. Every day, contractors' licensees are being suspended because their liability insurance is canceled or they cannot get a replacement policy. Many cases after 9/11, companies who were insured in the state of Oregon no longer even had an option to comply with the law. So what we did under the guise of consumer protection is we are making lots of money for one segment of the economy that really isn't part too big a part of Oregon, and we're completely wiping out a middle of our economy that just can't compete any longer. That's where both of these bills get to. I don't think there's a silver bullet, but this is a big push at this issue. I'd be delighted to answer any questions. You can tell I feel passionately about it because I've lost businesses. I've lost real, honest-to-God businesses in my district. I've had my little economies hurt. I've seen huge premiums be shipped out of state, and I have seen consumers not being protected, all because of, I think, a bogus requirement that we as policymakers put under there so that we feel good. I think we need to have some serious reform of construction contractor liability insurance. Mr. Chair, I'd be delighted to answer any questions.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Montesanto, do you have any questions for the senator?
Well, I do have, I need to understand a little bit more. If you get rid of liability, it seems like you're not protecting the consumer. I mean, that's doing business with the person who has to pay the insurance.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator, I don't think you're going to get to a world where people don't carry insurance. I think what this forces people to do, it allows fewer options for contractors. It allows insurance companies to abuse their clients in Oregon, and it gives them less choice. If you had the choice to decide between I'm going to go with this contractor who's insured or this one who's not, who are you going to go with? Most other states will allow contractors to put up a bond, and now you're covered under that bond, but not in Oregon. Doesn't work that way. And so I really don't believe, I believe that the best way to cover the consumer is to give contractors more options to get coverage. This false requirement really makes kings out of just a couple of insurance companies, but really does not provide anything for the consumer. For instance, if you had a claim against your contractor right now, who do you go to? Do you think the insurance companies are going to pay for your claim? No. That's not going to happen. If you go back to your contractor right now, do you think that contractor is going to keep? Do you think the insurance company is going to keep them insured? No. It's we've reached the absolute ceiling of competitive of being competitive right now, and contractors can't compete.
Maybe someone will have this information. I would think that there is a reason for the rates to go up, and I was just wondering if we have information on how many claims there have been that have warranted the increase in cost.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator. That's I think you're going to hear a whole variety of opinions, and I think everyone is going to point at 9/11, which certainly destroyed major chunks of our economy. And I think Mr. Leahy can speak to that question specifically. But let me just say before he speaks that why in Oregon should it be a half a million when in Washington State it's 250? Are we getting twice as much coverage? Are we getting twice as much consumer protection as Washington State? The answer is no, we're not.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Leahy.
Thank you, Senator. My name is Dan Leahy. I'm Vice President of Adair Home Corporation, whose home is here.
Sorry, what was the name of it?
Adair Home Corporation. The home is here in Oregon. We build several hundred homes a year in Oregon, Washington, and Idaho, and we've been in business since 1969. I have just a few brief comments, and if you'll allow me to go through them quickly, then I'll make myself available for questions. The most unworkable aspect of the compulsory liability insurance requirement for contractors in Oregon is simply the third-party provider aspect of it. This is a conflict that has now surfaced. If this law ever approximated consumer protection, it no longer does. So our circumstances have changed, and it has revealed the weaknesses in the assumptions behind the law. Two principal reasons, cost and the exclusions that these policies now contain, equal no effective insurance coverage. It's my opinion that this body, the legislature, since this law originated here, is culpable in maintaining that protections exist that, in fact, in the real world, do not. And if those protections or benefits do exist, they're almost impossible to identify. I'd like to take a couple minutes and speak, if I could, just outside of this issue to give some context from my perspective as to why we're here and how we can get out of this dilemma. And I'd like to start by asking the rhetorical question, what is a warranty? Because in Oregon, and because of the law that we operate under, warranty and insurance have been made to be synonymous, when in fact they're not. So I'd like to take a moment, if you don't mind, and draw a distinction between those two terms. In law, a warranty is a condition in an insurance contract in which the insured person guarantees that something is the case. It's a condition in an insurance contract in which the insured person guarantees that something is the case. So in fact, insurance is subordinate to warranty. But the way the law is written in Oregon, insurance is elevated to be synonymous with warranty. Now, why is this important? Because when you remove the insurance company, then who is the warranty between? The warranty is always between the two principal primary parties, in this case being the buyer of services, the homeowner, and a contractor. What Oregon law does is it inserts an intermediary, and the question at hand is that intermediary sufficient, competent, and appropriate for the task? I maintain that it is not. Let's talk a little bit about so-called warranty programs, such as the homeowner's 210 warranty, which is a third-party product, which is kind of an amalgam between insurance and home maintenance contracting. It's a strange brew, if you will. They're called warranty programs, but in fact, they're simply insurance programs. For a fee, the contractor's role is taken out of that scenario, and then the relationship is between this third party and the homeowner. Another interesting point, whether we're talking about so-called warranty programs or insurance, and I find myself saying this a lot when I'm testifying on system development charge issues, which is all the hot topic now, all the way from infrastructure requirements to funding of schools. And this is something that we have to remind ourselves of constantly, is that builders and developers pay for nothing. And that's, we hear that over and over again. Well, let the developer pay for it. Pay as you go. Well, it's rhetoric. Builders and developers pay for nothing. We're a service industry. We have very little capital and equity requirements in order to operate our companies. That's simply the way of the world. In fact, it is the customer who pays. We simply add it to the price of the home or whatever improvement is being made and pass it along. So let's not forget that, if we will, very important distinction, because it is the consumer who pays and pays and pays. The question at hand today is, are they getting anything for what they're paying? So I've said again, a warranty is always between primary parties, whether or not intermediaries are inserted into that relationship or not. One thing is for sure, the more parties that are involved, the less communication, accountability, and responsibility will be found. On September 11th, 2001, Adair's insurance company was Swiss Re, the very same company that held the insurance policy on the Twin Towers. Significant? Maybe. But since then, we've talked to scores, if not 100 insurance companies. And it makes no difference whether insurance carrier Swiss Re or some other insurance carrier, they're all singing the same tune. And we have what is now a protected market created by this law, and there's simply no free market activity or characteristic to this insurance provision in Oregon anymore. I will say, at the risk of this becoming a commercial for Adair, we do place a 10-year warranty on our homes because we want to be accountable for our product. We understand that's good business. It is a no-premium, no-deductible warranty that is serviced by the very same people who built the home. It's a true warranty. And every builder in Oregon and elsewhere has the prerogative, the freedom, to provide an express warranty if they choose to. That's a question that ought to be asked, particularly in the market of free ideas. And finally, let me end with this statement, which I understand is a mouthful. But if you want competitive commerce and high-quality goods and services, limit the use of intermediaries, including government regulation. Provide a fair, unbiased system of justice based on common sense and judges who will, one, honor the traditional notions of fault, meaning surprisingly enough, that somebody really might be at fault, and it might not always be the contractor. And number two, judges who will respect what legislators tell them the law is. And that's a discussion for another day. And finally, I would say that I personally am willing to go out of business if I can't compete. But I prefer to compete on a level, fair and level playing field. And Oregon's compulsory insurance requirement makes that impossible. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lay. We have, as Senator Atkinson knows, stating the committee, a lot of issues dealing with contractors' insurance. We had a number of bills last month that we're still considering, because I think there is a general feeling among the committee that this is a, you know, it's a critical industry. We have problems. I mean, I think you were articulating some of those other ones. So part of our issue in trying to figure out what is the best way to attack that. But I want to, as I was pushing back on the insurance folks a few weeks ago, I'll push back on you a little bit, following up on Senator Monis Anderson, about the role of protecting the consumer, though. I represent the city of Sandy, and I think Adair just had a major settlement on a home. Is that correct?
That's correct.
In my city. So I would be curious as to, you know, your perspective in terms of, I assume your insurance played a role in is going to be playing a role in paying that settlement. In terms of how you see that in terms of protecting the consumer, because obviously their interest is in settling claims, their interest is in you know, their liability to you as their the person they represent. And if that insurance wasn't in place, then how is the consumer going to be as well protected? So I want to push back on that a little bit. Have you give me a scenario? Maybe you even using that example.
Sure. Well, I wish I could say you chose one that would advance your question. In point of fact, I can't speak freely about the case because it's ongoing, but in point of fact, the very nature of that claim is excluded by our insurance. As it is, you simply cannot get insurance for that coverage item or for that particular matter. Adair's insurance policy is over 60 pages long, and over half of those pages are in fact exclusions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know. I have one of those, and I called my agent and I on our own business and asked, "What am I covered for?"
Sure.
You know, I got 60 pages of what I'm not covered for, and I kind of wondered what the premium was for. So I had empathy with that.
I wanted to give you a direct answer, and I didn't do it. In that particular instance that you attempted to use as an example, insurance will pay not one dime. In fact, they didn't even show up.
Mm-hmm.
No coverage.
Mr. Chair, can I add
one thing
that I forgot? I'm looking through my cryptic notes here, and I don't believe that I mentioned, perhaps you recall, last session we ran an emergency piece of legislation that would give authority to the, forgive me if I get the wording wrong, but give authority to the CCB by rule to take a look at this issue.
Mm-hmm.
And to maintain consumer protection, which is why we even have a CCB, and their board of directors to see if we can do two things. One, have consumer protection upheld. Number two, deal with these obnoxious rates. And when nothing happened, not for lack of trying, but really, I know there's representatives here from the Attorney General's office, but they pretty much said through letters that no reform's necessary, everything's fine, consumers are being protected. That's why we're just going to keep this thing at $500,000. In the meantime, between then and today is when four of my businesses in my district went out. One little piece I thought I'd add.
Right.
Senator, should I add one other point?
Yeah, please.
Along that same line, it's interesting to note that I like to, you know, to describe to my own people in our own company how Adair is in business forever. And that's not a particularly broadly held sentiment in construction contracting. It's a project-oriented industry. People go in and businesses go in and out of business all the time. They may, in fact, start another subdivision or start another commercial building and whatnot, but it's that project nature of the industry tends to support this transitory view of the construction trades. In fact, it's not very accurate, but it's not true, but it tends to be accurate. The interesting thing about about Adair's business is that we sell and build pre-sold homes, meaning we build only on contract. And a frightening thing for us is that at any given point in time, forever, doesn't matter what day of the 365 days of the year you choose, we are under contract to between 350 and 450 families in the Northwest. 2 years ago, we had one insurance company that would even quote our business. The rate was regardless. The coverage was regardless. We only had could find one company that would even quote our business. That's how close to the precipice we came. And had that, had we not, and I remember having a conversation with the CCB administrator the evening of the due date, while our insurance broker was on I-5 traveling to Salem to file that policy binder, and telling them, had we not been able to get insurance coverage that day, we would have had all those contracts, we would have been out of compliance with Oregon state law, and where would we have been? Where would that homeownership have been? Does that constitute consumer protection? It's a very weak position to try to argue.
Any questions?
Well, we have contractors coming up, Mr. Chair.
Well, we have a couple more people signed up to testify.
Okay. Yeah. I have a contractor question.
Yeah. My name is Mr. Lay. I can probably answer that.
It was brought to my attention earlier that in the olden days, we would build houses when the weather was good.
Mm-hmm.
And the sun was shining and we had dry weather. And now rules have changed where we have to completely wrap up a house. I don't know what that means, but
sure.
You know what it means. Okay. And you can build in the middle of the winter or during the rain, springtime during the rains. And so to me, it would be common sense for a contractor not to want to build during the rainy season when you have to wrap a house up completely, where that's going to trap the condensation and cause all sorts of problems. So, you know, the industry, the codes are changing. You have to have an airtight house, and yet you're building, and whether that cause. So I would think, hopefully, that the industry would take a look at that and somehow fix the problem so that they're... You wouldn't run into liability issues like
Thank
that.
Thank you, and I appreciate your comment. It's a good observation. You know, short of taking you by the hand into the field and showing you what we do and what other builders do to address those very issues, it's difficult to address. The fact of the point is, and I mentioned this earlier, I'm willing and eager to be held accountable for my conduct in the field. That's really not at issue here, because even when I am, I may or may not get credit for it on that on my you know I may not be treated on my merit, and that's what Senator Atkins and I are trying to convey to you today, and that is that the system no longer reflects an accountability which we all presume to be present in our commercial realm in business and in our the way we deal with one another as citizens. To the degree that we can keep people operating directly with one another, functioning and communicating specifically with one another, and be accountable to one another, then you have an atmosphere where high performance and high accountability can be expected. But we have an arbitrary, impersonal, and incompetent tool in place that simply keeps people apart, has the implication of coverage or security, but in fact provides no such thing. And that's the real crime. I use that word loosely, but that's the real rub here, is that it's just not competent. It's not doing what the legislature originally intended for it to do. Let me skip over and say what might constitute protection for the consumer. Adair Homes, for one, would be more than happy to post a bond on every job that we build. More than happy to. If, in fact, the terms of that bond were competent, that they actually constituted coverage and protection. But the way that the law is written now, and we had that confirmed for us in the last session by the Attorney General's office, we're stuck. and that's why the law has to be changed. It can't even be tweaked, because the Attorney General's opinion was that even though there was this emergency legislation which allowed the CCB to allow, forgive me if I don't get the correct word, but equivalent, I believe, protection through another means, a builder could bring another proposal forward. In the end, even though certain proposals were brought forward, which were material and substantial in nature, the Attorney General's office decided that, in fact, if it was not in fact insurance by a third party, then it could not suffice in a legal sense. And so that emergency legislation was inadequate in its attempt to provide relief.
Well, you answered one of my questions, and Senator Axens had brought it up, was about bond as an option for that. I know in our Transportation Committee, which I served on, last session, talking more about what we have as an option for people, instead of having liability car insurance, can post bonds, to do that rather than and carry that. So we certainly have used that in different forms. We've been talking about a number of ways to address these kinds of issues, and some of those individuals are, as no surprise to you, or I see, are sitting in the back of the audience today. But to address this issue of a contractor, the costs and what's happening, we've talked about liability limitations, warranty timelines. Mr. Berry from the Home Builders, we recently just heard a bill about filing warranty information with the deeds of new construction to be able to have a chance to find out what's covered there. Arbitration issues, lowering the or extending rather the ability of builders to mitigate issues that come up before court is initiated. A lot of different ways to try and get to what I think the committees I mentioned before really does see is a real problem. And I have one question for you, though, because you are a large builder, and I'm certainly familiar with a couple of other large builders in the industry. Have you had the experience with the DARE? Have you, in the state of Oregon, feel like you've been targeted at all by what we would call the ambulance-chasing folks that come into your neighborhoods and create problems and that they say have to exist and find yourself under the gun on a regular basis for that? Have you had that experience yet?
I can't say that I can identify it positively. From time to time, there are spurious efforts, but like I said, we're in business forever, and those efforts tend to be very transient. They're opportunistic, and so we're fairly confident we can outlast nefarious types of pot shots, if you will, at our industry and at our business. I think what's more central to the issue is, and again, I don't want to backtrack too far, but there is a material difference between liability insurance that I, as a business person, might choose to carry to protect myself, my assets, and then this whole other issue of using insurance as a consumer protection vehicle. Mm-hmm. It's incompetent. It doesn't work well. It's a blunt instrument that's no longer even picked up, doesn't show up on behalf of the consumer. It really, insurance does not show up on issues that consumers really need the protection on. Mm-hmm. And interestingly enough, this is all anecdotal, I understand, but interestingly enough, the two insurance claims that Adair has, that in 10 years with the company that I'm aware of, two insurance claims that were ever handled for Adair by our insurance carriers, both of them were decisions that were made unilaterally by our insurance carrier without consulting us first. It was basically done on an economic basis. It was cheaper to pay the claim than to fight it and so forth. Had we been consulted, we would have been eager to go out and fix that problem. Mm-hmm. Eager. And that's what you'll find with most people who are in business forever, is that they value their reputation and they want to be in the marketplace correcting mistakes when mistakes have been identified. The others need to be let to go out of business.
Well, I appreciate your thoughts, and I think that some of your testimony today, I think, has contributed to the discussion we've had with some of these other bills. And I appreciate that very much. Thank you both very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Let's bring up Gordon Trouder and Dean Aldridge. Why don't you both come up? Next, that's fine on my list. And then I will ask for the, and just to let you know, I'm going to ask the CCB in a bit to give some comments and observations to the testimony we've had.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Trotter, you're the first on the list to sign up, so why don't you go ahead first?
Chair Metzger, members of the committee, I'm Gordon Trotter. I am a contractor, small contractor, and actually Senator Atkinson read one of my emails I sent to him. I am a casualty of the...
That's good. Put that on there. We actually read your emails. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I'm impressed. Anyway, but since I've sent the email to the senator, I have received an insurance quote. The quote was for $20,758. And what this coverage is for, they allow me to do $160,000 in subcontract and a payroll of $8,000. That's enough for me to build two modest homes. So I'm paying my insurance company over $10,000 per house. And there's not enough confidence that I can afford that. And I shopping for other rates. To get this one quote, I've shopped 3 months, four different insurance companies, countless phone calls, faxes, information, and I managed to get this one quote, and it's so high that I can't afford it. Besides the high rates, insurance companies are also saying if you want us to insure you, you have to do business the way we say. They dictate what I cannot do in the job, what I'm allowed to do, how much work I have to do myself, what insurance coverage my subcontractors have, what my contracts have to stipulate in them. And to follow their guidelines, I am not most efficient. Certain items I'm good at, they say you can't do it. For instance, roofing. They say you cannot roof. They say you have to do at least 50% of the work yourself. Sometimes it's more efficient to hire a framer to do it that does it every day of the year than to me that will frame maybe a couple houses a year, not much. Anyway, personally, if this bill doesn't pass, I'm out of business. I'll be forced to relocate to another state that doesn't require liability insurance. In my case, I brought in $800,000 into the state from investors I've convinced to relocate the money from mainly down in California. I have family members down there, convinced them to invest up here. I'm going to have to take that money with me. You know, I'm a drop in the bucket. You know, I won't affect the economy one way or the other. But if there's lots of people like me, if there's 1,000 people like me, that would be $800 million going out of the state. That is significant. And as far as the question about consumer protection, as contractors, we are liable. We have money invested and lots of it. A good percentage of my net worth is invested in my company. And that is on the line. If we don't produce a product that is good, we're liable to pay out of our own pockets, whether or not we have insurance. Thank you for listening to me today.
Thank you very much. I do have one question, because you represent the different spectrum than Mr. Leahy with Adair.
Yes.
So I'll kind of ask you the same kind of question that I did Mr. Leahy. So they're a large company, you know, with a large asset. So if I'm a consumer, and you mentioned, you know, your cost, $20,000, which, you know, is, like you mentioned, a significant amount of money, and what that would add to the cost of your doing business. But if I'm the consumer,
mm-hmm.
and I have a claim against you, and this is such an expensive part of your business, because you operate, you know, obviously on a smaller scale than an Adair Homes does,
mm-hmm.
then isn't the insurance, at least, even though it does not protect what Mr. Lay was actually referring to as a mold issue, which they're not covering now, which he's absolutely right, which is part of, that's another discussion. Mm-hmm. But in terms of my protection as a consumer to collect from you, if you're kind of operating within the narrows, then who is going to pay that claim to me as a consumer?
Well, it would be coming from my own personal funds if I didn't have insurance. But one advantage of being a small contractor, I am able to closely monitor each phase of construction, and the likelihood of problems coming up versus mass production housing are significantly less.
What about Mr. Leahy's comment about we would prefer and would be happy to post bonds in lieu of having to buy insurance at these rates? How would that impact a small contractor like yourself?
That I don't know, because the bonds are bought through insurance companies. It could be the same type of situation where they would make bonds so costly that it would be prohibitive.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony. Thank you. Any questions for our guest? Senator Atkins.
Thank you for coming, and it does make a big difference if you go out of business. You're not just a drop in the bucket. Because I have four drops in the bucket, as you would say, in my district, and that's a lot of families who are affected. So thank you, and it's nice. I've never met you before, but thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
And
Senator
Monasanger. Yes. Yeah. And when I was campaigning, walking door to door, I ran into very odd, I would say, three contractors who voiced the same concern that you are today. Yeah.
Thanks. Thank you very much. Okay. Mm-hmm. You have the floor.
Oh, thank you. Chairman, senators, my name is Dean Aldrich. I'm a lawyer from Portland. My law firm has about six lawyers in it, and we do almost exclusively construction defect litigation. I come from Oregon. I have a degree in civil engineering. My degree in law is from Tulane. I have been a contractor before. I've worked for a contractor in Oregon, and then I've also been involved in the construction industry all throughout high school and college. What we do is, for the most part, we represent Oregon property owners who have problems with construction defects and resultant property damage. One other aspect of our practice is we do represent developers and contractors when they have problems with their insurance companies. So we will represent a developer or a contractor to try and get insurance coverage, notwithstanding any exclusions that the insurance company may try and pan down on the contractor. In terms of the scope of our practice, I started the firm in 2000. We've done about 250 construction defect claims. They range in size from $50,000 to, we've had damages in one case, over $10 million. And of the cases that have settled, it's probably about 150 of them, we've obtained $37 million in settlement money. And that settlement money has been used to repair these defective buildings, residential and commercial structures. With regard to that $37 million, over 99.6% of that has come directly from the insurance companies. Now,
it is.
The numbers, as I speak about them now, are serious, and they're real, and they're serious to Oregon property owners, because they're the ones who are stuck with the construction that they bought and paid for and now have to fix. And what I've attached onto the materials is photographs of some of the damage on some of the projects that we've been involved with, so it isn't simply ambulance chasing. This is something that's a serious problem for Oregon property owners. Now, putting these numbers of claims, even if I include other law firms that do construction defect here in Oregon, up against the construction total dollars and number of projects built, construction in Oregon is a $6 billion industry annually. That comes from the 2002 census, which was just published by the government in 2004. So we're not talking about an epidemic, hopefully. We're talking about a few projects that go very bad. And my point in saying that is I don't think the fact that we're doing a lot of construction here, some projects go bad. You look at the percentage, I mean, it's just the risk of construction. Some projects go bad. This is not an excuse from my standpoint for the insurance company to be raising their rates, but they're using it as part of their excuse along with another of other items in which to raise their rates. And as far as construction defects go, kind of the statement of the problem from what we practice is basically leaky buildings. There's been a lot of leaky buildings. It started in the 90s with regard to a synthetic stucco product known as EIFS, or exterior insulation. And then once the market forces drove that out of business, then we ended up seeing a lot more claims just relating to siding and windows and so forth, and the claims still continue to occur. And from my experience in this, the construction defect problem has a few main causes. One is, and it was just alluded to by this gentleman, which is on some of these larger projects, we don't have proper quality control and oversight on the building residential construction projects. We just don't have that. We have improperly trained and inexperienced workforces. And this is a symptom of a building boom, basically in Oregon. And that's just happened, and unfortunately, people who forgot that it rains in Oregon, I mean, look at it now, but typically it does rain in Oregon, and water runs into a building, and if you don't put it together right, you're going to have damages, particularly with the use of current products and the Oregon Energy Code, because it allows, a lot of times, if you don't construct the building right, water will get trapped in there and will fester. And when that happens, you have serious damage. Again, look at the pictures. I mean, we're talking about serious damage. Somebody's paid hundreds of thousands of dollars sometime for a house or for a commercial building, and it gets rotted out, and they have to basically, within 10 years, pay for it again, pay for the reconstruction. Now, several bills we have here, including these insurance bills, have been introduced this year that deal with some of these issues. Now, none of these bills address the problems that I just talked about. They're all kind of an after-the-fact measure to eliminate liability for insurance companies, to shorten time frames, and it basically puts the burden of all these repairs on the shoulders of the consumer, of the owners, because they bought a building, they paid for it, and now we're trying to change the game after the fact rather than trying to solve the problem at the get-go, which is through increased training and increased supervision on the sites. And anyway, getting to the these bills, they don't address the problems either. We're just cutting out insurance. Now, what that's going to do is a couple of things. Like when I said, we've got $37 million in settlements that have been used back in the economy to hire repair contractors to fix these buildings. The 99.6% of that was paid by insurance companies. Now, that money would be gone if contractors didn't have insurance, because in many circumstances, contractors have gone out of business, and they don't have, and they're gone, and the insurance stays there. So that does provide consumer protection. So we're looking at about, at least in my little area of these defects, you know, close to $37 million of insurance funds that otherwise would not have been there had there not been insurance. And also, it protects the contractors as well. I mean, if there's no insurance, I mean, some of these projects go bad in a real big way, and that's going to put a guy out of business. I mean, more than paying an insurance premium. I mean, if you get stuck, you know, if you got sued for $50,000 or $100,000, you'd probably want to leave the state as well.
Yeah, it would probably take most of my savings.
And, you know, and and so these bills don't help him. They don't help the consumer. I mean, I agree something needs to be done with this insurance problem, because I don't know if there's insurance lobbyists here, but I hate insurance companies. I mean, I hate them when I represent contractors. I hate them when I represent property owners, too, because like you were saying earlier, Chairman, you know, you get a 60-page policy. It says the first sentence is we cover everything except, and then you have 60 pages of exclusions. I mean, it's tough to get through there, and it's tough to get those insurance companies to cover. But eventually they do if you pound on them hard enough. And also I want to relate back to a CCB resolution that was passed in May of this year, where they found that contractors working without insurance are, quote, putting their customers, their businesses, and Oregon's vitality at risk. I mean, I think we've got a problem here, but these two measures are going the wrong way to try and solve it. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Questions from the committee?
No. One comment.
Yes, Senator Ackerman.
Thank you for coming. I disagree with you passionately. I don't believe that an insurance company in New York City is going to provide adequate oversight to a large building project in downtown Portland.
Well, that's...
And I just think that this is a false barrier, that a gentleman like this has got to pay. He's getting nothing for this. Nothing. He's not putting money away for his kids. He's not growing his business. He's not doing more things with his business. He's getting nothing for for it. The consumers have to pay more money for it, and they get nothing. So who's making out on this deal?
The insurance company.
Not him.
Neither are the consumers. Like I said, there's a problem. These measures don't address that. And one, the construction oversight doesn't come from the insurance company. That's got to be done by the contractors. The problem is the insurance companies are going, wow, you know, we've got defective construction out here. We need to jump up the rates. And so we're kind of caught with our pants down right now. We've got a lot of crappy buildings out there. Not a lot of them, but a substantial percentage of them that are failing. And you don't solve that problem right now by eliminating insurance requirements. You don't solve that problem by limitations on actions against contractors. You eliminate the problem by training and making sure people have adequate tools to build these things right. And as far as insurance rates go, what a lot of these projects, like I said, $37 million, that's going back and repair these projects. These aren't projects that I'm going around door to door going, hey, you got a problem with your building. I mean, look at these pictures. And these are pictures from projects on the coast, from Portland, from Salem, all throughout the state that have problems. And I forgot where I was going there. But
you're
anyway.
Going good.
Huh?
You were going good, though. I have a question for you, Mr. Yeah. Alders, though. Is and we'll be wrapping up this hearing, the last one, set the test fire there. Well, I'm going to ask a comment from CCB before we close this particular public hearing. But your comment to Mr. Leahy's suggestion about, you know, allowing contractors to post bonds in lieu of carrying insurance. From your perspective, do you have an opinion on that one way or another?
I think that's fine if some system is set up that protects consumers and you take the insurance companies out, but then you're going to put the government in the role of trying to arbitrate what claims get paid and what don't. I mean, I would like that more than the way the insurance company's going right now. And one thing I will say with regard to these insurance rates, what we're seeing on larger construction projects as well as some of these repair projects, they're becoming a separate line item in the construction contract. They become sometimes 1% of the project price, and so the consumer, the building owner, can see that right up front. And so they can choose their insurance. But, you know, the problem with pre-manufactured homes or pre-sold homes and condominiums, consumers don't have, if you take this insurance requirement out, regardless of whether you think it works or it doesn't, they don't have a choice. They can't go to the contractor and see whether he has insurance or not. I mean, they're just basically relying on this law because they have no way to communicate with the contractor because they're buying from a developer.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you both for coming.
Thank you very much for your time.
Mr. Crowder, thanks for coming. It's good to have both ends of the home building spectrum, which we have today. Lots of CCB kind of hit to clean up on this issue, and then we're going to move to Senate Bill 210.
Chair Masker and members of the committee, Craig Smith, I've got a couple of handouts to pass out. Just go over this very briefly. Senate Bill 554, of course, this is the one that would eliminate the insurance mandate. And before I get started, I need to personally thank Senator Atkinson. This takes guts to bring this issue to the fore. I'm not sure what the resolution is, but I thank him for bringing this topic up. This particular bill would eliminate the insurance mandates. I've tried to outline what the problems are on my handout here. You have a very interesting policy debate. On page 2, I think I've tried to sum it up the way I see it. And it's a real cost-benefit analysis. The question is, does the cost of the mandated insurance exceed, or at least equal, the benefit given to consumers and the economy? I can't answer that question for you. I can't answer that question for myself. This is a difficult question, and I think it's at the crux of whether or not you mandate liability insurance coverage. If you didn't mandate it, some people would carry it. Others wouldn't. The problem is, for many contractors and organizations, is they're a little afraid of that free market solution because you would end up with an unlevel playing field. They're concerned. Because if I carry the insurance and I'm bearing a $50,000 a year policy and my partner or my competitor is not, how can I compete? And if I choose then not to carry the insurance, am I putting my customers, am I putting my business at risk? So therein lies part of the problem with eliminating insurance.
That said, I should tell you that this is a topic that the Construction Contractors Board has been struggling with. They've been working with the insurance industry, members like Senator Atkinson and others, trying to find solutions. I can tell you that it tears at the heart of many of the members of the Construction Contractors Board. At this point, though, they have not given me authority to support this particular measure.
Mr. Smith, I have a question for you. Mr. Leahy pointed out, and as said, did Senator Atkinson, experiences with some of our neighboring states. On a peer level, have you had discussions or had the occasion to interact with some of those individuals who represent states who have eliminated this particular requirement, or, as in the case of Washington, have a lesser insurance requirement, and have any anecdotal information about how that has impacted their consumer protections versus where we are in Oregon?
Senator Mesker, it's a good question. With the tight controls on spending, I don't go out of state, so I don't visit my counterparts. I wish at some point I hope to.
Trying to promote tourism. You can ask them to come and visit you.
I'll work on that. I have talked over the phone with the folks in Washington. They do have half the coverage, but most of the cost is not proportional. Most of the problem occurs in the first $100,000 or $200,000 worth of coverage. So by cutting the requirement in half, you don't save half of the premium cost, is what I've been told. In addition to that, the folks in California, I hate to admit it, but I am a Californian. I was born there, and so I suppose I can say this, that they do things a little differently, and I can't tell you that they necessarily do it better. That said, it is very few states that have a state-mandated insurance requirement for licensing law. Most states don't do that. This state did it many, many years ago, but when they chose to implement that requirement, the cost of insurance was a few hundred dollars, maybe $1,000 on average. Today, as I report to you in these survey results, the average home builder is paying over $8,000. Now, that's not the home builders, but that's the specialty as well as the home builders. If we took a look and just took a very small average of $10,000 per contractor with 42,000 contractors, that's $420 million that are going out into premiums. And I suspect to you it could be higher, the total amount of money that's given by consumers to insurance to protect their interests through contractors' insurance premiums. So it's a lot of money. And I wish I could sit here today and tell you the value that consumers get from it. I have no way to measure that. And as to the issue of bonding, it certainly would help with the improper work that shows at the time that the contract ends. But what happens 9 years later? Is the bond still there? And what about accidents that occur on a job, personal injuries, deaths, other injuries? I'm not sure if a bond could be structured to cover that. Perhaps so. I don't know.
Mr. Smith, thank you. Any questions? You have voluminous material here. Obviously, we can't look at it once. It's fascinating, and we'll definitely try to analyze some of the data, a lot of data that you've given us. I think it would be helpful, though, if you wouldn't mind taking the time maybe to discuss with your counterparts, and if they have some material that now that we have the amazing world of electronic communication, if they have accumulated any similar data in terms of that we might be able to have some type of comparison as to what's fact and what's fiction in terms of operating contracting, for example, in the state of California without that requirement as per here. Even if it's anecdotal, that would be helpful, but certainly data to support that. Because as I mentioned earlier, we have a lot of these contractor issues. I think we're really concerned about that, and every approach does have some pitfalls in it, and we're trying to figure out what's the best way to go. And I would like the committee to be able to make some progress on this issue, because it is important to our economy, and we've got to make sure that people are in business and the consumer is protected at the same time. So thank you very much, Mr. Smith. That's the last person we have set to testify on this bill, but again, we are dealing with these issues, and we will be continuing to deal with it. We're going to close public hearing, Senate Bills 514, 554. And we're going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 210. And
let's ask, well, I've got a number of people signed up for this bill. Only two have told me where they are in the bill. So I'll ask them to come up first. Kevin Neely and Leif Hansen. Have signed up as proponents. Well, in fact, Teresa, why don't you go ahead and since we have some other people, give us the synopsis of what 210 does so for people in the audience that may not be associated with this bill.
Certainly, Mr. Chair, committee members. Senate Bill 210 requires motor vehicle repair shops to display a sign disclosing preferred provider agreements with motor vehicle insurance companies. It makes a failure of a repair shop to display the required preferred provider sign or a sign noting that the insurer may not require that repairs be made by a particular person or shop an unlawful trade practice.
Okay. So, Mr. Neely.
Thank you, Senator, again for hearing the bill. This is a bill from the Department of Justice, and consequently we do support the bill. However, we have... it's a good step in the right direction, isn't it? We do have a Dash 1 amendment that we'd like to offer on this bill. But again, I think that Ms. Van Winkle properly described the bill. The Dash 1 amendment to the bill does change the actual language that is required to be posted by the auto repair facility. It also, as presently drafted, requires those collision repair centers to actually list the names of the insurers that they have preferred provider agreements with. I don't think preferred provider agreement, in fact, I'm certain it's not a term of art in the industry. I think there may well be a bunch of different names that these agreements go by depending on the insurer. But the reason that we brought this bill to you is a very simple reason. It's the Attorney General's very, I think, sound belief that disagreements between consumers and businesses often can be averted if consumers have a full palette of information. And we believe that, in fact, if a consumer walks into a shop and sees a sign that says, we have an agreement with an insurer, that that may well incite that consumer to ask the company about that agreement. And then, hopefully, the company will disclose the terms of the agreement to the best of their ability. That will give the consumer a complete set of tools with which to make a decision as to whether or not they want to do business with that particular company. Hopefully, that will, at the end of the day, lessen the chance that our office receives a complaint. Our office averages about 40 complaints annually related to these so-called collision centers or body shops, as you guys probably have seen them called. That's not a exceptionally high number. But again, I think one of the things that you need to remember when you're getting your vehicle repaired, there's a whole bunch of things that go into that repair. And I can tell you that in the course of the last 3 weeks since we've introduced this bill, I've learned a lot about collision repair. And I didn't know a lot going into this.
I hope it wasn't firsthand.
No, it wasn't. But I have to admit that that when this bill was proposed, it was right in the aftermath of me having a little bit of firsthand information about it. And that's in part what I think inspired me to ask the Attorney General to introduce this bill. But again, at the end of the day, there are a lot of factors that go into a safe, a sound repair of a collision. And in fact, you might not be able to see those from the outside of your vehicle. And you need to have complete confidence in the center or the repair shop that you're using to ensure that, in fact, that vehicle is properly repaired. And obviously the consequences of an improperly repaired vehicle can be very catastrophic and very expensive. So again, the purpose of this bill from the perspective of the Department of Justice is a very simple purpose, and that is to essentially provide additional information for consumers so that hopefully we can avert disagreements between those insurers or those auto repair shops and the consumer. I would add that that in fact, as I said, these preferred provider agreements are not a term of art, and it's my understanding, and others are signed up to testify who know a lot more about this than I do, that the vast majority of repair shops do in fact have agreements with insurers, and in many instances the consumers either don't know that or have no information about what those agreements contain. And I really do think that it is a genuine benefit to the consumer to understand the terms of the arrangement between the insurer who is, in fact, referring that work to a specific shop and the shop. At the end of the day, that can do nothing but help the consumer. Our goal here was to try and find very neutral language that didn't steer a consumer either away or to a specific shop. The initial language in the bill we felt was a little bit too one-sided. It made it sound like all of these preferred provider agreements were bad things. In fact, I don't think that's the case. Some may, in fact, provide a benefit for consumers. So we changed the language to try and, again, provide a neutral message. This shop has an agreement. Here's who we have an agreement with. And hopefully, again, that provides consumers with additional information. I would add, I have heard from array of folks about this bill. We've tried to work with people to make this bill a more palatable bill for people, but again, there are people on both sides of this. Some want the original language, some want the new language. The insurers would like to see us remove the actual names of the insurance companies, and we're willing to sit down and talk to them about that and whether or not that's a reasonable alternative. And again, I think our goal here at the end of the day is to have a better product for consumers, and we're certainly happy to work with all the folks who have signed up there to try and find a way to do that. If you have any questions, I'd be more than pleased to answer them.
Thank you, Mr. Neely. I do have one question for you.
Mm-hmm.
You talked about the complaints that you track from collision repair centers. So have you attempted to juxtapose these complaints with preferred provider agreements? In other words, this complaint came and it was contracted with a firm that was using a preferred provider. And have you put those side by side to see whether there's a parallel there?
Mr. Chair, we haven't, primarily because we don't know who has preferred provider agreements. And again, I think that really speaks to the necessity of this bill. I can tell you that we have looked at the complaints and we have tried to identify those instances in which the complaint was related to some level of repair, the quality of the repair. In some instances, these preferred provider agreements require non-original equipment manufacturer parts. And so we've tried to take a look at whether or not the complaints may have fit into the problems ideally addressed by this bill, and it's very difficult to do without actually knowing if they have a preferred provider agreement. So I think the answer, that's a very long answer to your question, and my actual answer is we've tried it, haven't been successful.
Any questions for Mr. Neely at this point? Senator Starr.
And I apologize for missing your testimony, so if you covered this in the testimony, I apologize. But as I've reviewed your testimony, or your written testimony in the bill, the question that I have is, what do other states do as it relates to this particular issue and this preferred provider agreement? Is that allowed in other states? Do other states prohibit that even? I mean, can you give us a little bit of a snapshot of where does Oregon rank among our neighbors?
Chair Metzger, Senator Starr, unfortunately, I can't. I suspect that this is a standard practice throughout the industry in every state, but I'll go back and do a little bit of homework on determining what at least our Western friends are doing in their states.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions?
Yes, Mr.
Okay.
Chair. I would think that it would be very easy for any vehicle repair shop to just put the sign in, whether they had insurance or not.
Chair Metzger, Senator Moss-Anderson, again, we don't think this is a significant imposition on the repair shops. They already are required to post one sign, and again, this would just be one additional sign. And it seems like a relatively low-impact way of providing additional tools for consumers.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Thank you.
So I assume Mr. Hansen is not here, because I called him up and he didn't show. So then my next person would be... Oh, well, come up. I called you. In fact, why don't we have Fred Lenenko and Don Braden come up as well. The three of you.
I apologize. I didn't hear
that. It's all right. So I'll make sure I get the order here. Looks like we're in the same business here. So... But Mr. Hansen, we'll start with you.
Okay. Good afternoon. I'm going to read this, if you don't mind. Chair Metzger, Vice Chair Starr, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here today. My name is Leif Hansen. I am the owner of Leif's Auto Collision Centers in Portland.
I have been in the collision repair industry for more than 30 years. I am a journeyman repair technician and have operated my business in the state of Oregon since 1991. I proudly employ more than 60 people, most of whom enjoy family wage and above incomes with full benefits. I'm here today to testify and support a Senate Bill 210. I have provided members of the committee my full statement for the record, including some background on the issue of auto body repair, insurance companies, and how these issues affect Oregon consumers and their rights under Oregon law. Insurance company direct programs, also known as DRPs generically, were created by the insurance industry more than 10 years ago. These programs impact tens of thousands of Oregonian consumers every year, yet they are completely unregulated. Senate Bill 210 before you today does not attempt to address these DRP programs. However, these programs and the need for Oregon consumers to have access to this information are the primary reasons behind Senate Bill 210 and why I urge you to give this bill your full support. At the appropriate time, the issue of direct repair programs is one I strongly encourage this committee and the legislature to explore in the near future. For many Oregonians, improper repair of their vehicle is a potential life and death issue. Included in the summary I have provided the committee is the actual language proposed for the sign to be posted in shops with preferred provider agreements. That language has been amended. For the record, I would like to state that the original language as first submitted offers much more consumer information. To provide context for Senate Bill 210 and for the record, I would like to briefly offer some background on the DRP programs. At the surface, these DRP programs look benign and sound terrific. By directing auto accident victims to a repaired shop that the insurance company has an agreement with, these programs promise faster and better service, guarantees, higher quality repairs. Actually, if you look closely at the data, the opposite is true. We have collected volumes of documentations over the last 5 years to back this up, which I can share with you at your request. Insurers and body shops have developed a mutual protection system. The system encourages these body shops to perform shoddy repairs and give kickbacks in the form of hidden discounts to various insurers in exchange for the referrals to repair accidents. This agreement is covered by the insurers in protecting the shops from consumers who complained about the shoddy work. By telling the vehicle owner that the work is adequate and within acceptable industry standards. I have detailed this in my written testimony, and in the interest of time, I will only summarize it today. Our surveys over the last 5 years, backed by similar surveys from other shops around the country, show that approximately 90% of structurally damaged vehicles repaired at preferred shops are shoddy and or fail to meet manufacturer's standards and or are unsafe to drive. Our company has been instrumental in assisting hundreds of consumers get the insurance company to re-repair these vehicles, or in dozens of cases, because of the horrible repairs, total the vehicle out and buy it back for the consumer. It is estimated that over 50% of vehicle repairs are performed at these preferred shops in Oregon. This translates into tens of thousands of vehicles on the road today that are potentially a hazard to the occupants and others on the road. In the last year in Portland alone, I have personally observed written accounts in the Oregonian of three accidents that resulted in the deaths of one or more of the occupants that may and most likely were due to poor repairs. And this is where the cars actually split in half upon impact, which does not happen during an accident. They crush. They don't break in half. And the pictures in the newspaper were of cars actually in two pieces. It doesn't happen in an accident. Only because of a bad repair did this happen. Various insurers demand that their shops must use inferior parts, cut labor and materials to stay on the referral program. These insurance companies, insurance programs, have effectively put a muzzle on the body shop industry. The potential of a body shop losing half of its business if they don't follow the insurer's rules has placed the consumer into a position where there is absolutely no one on their side. The shops won't help, there is no government agency that will intervene, and the insurer's first interest is always going to be their own. These insurance repair programs have effectively circumvented and rendered meaningless the current consumer protection statute in Oregon, which prohibits an insurer from requiring that repairs be made at a particular shop. Insurers have carefully worded the word tracks that they read to consumers to give consumers the illusion of choice through a false sense of security in the insurance company's program shops. Worse, these insurers know these shops are performing poor repairs but continue to steer consumers to them. The current statute in Oregon did not anticipate the invention of DRP programs by insurance companies. Oregon should follow the lead of other states which have adopted legislation to regulate and even prohibit various types of DRP programs. By adopting legislation here in Oregon that protects consumers by requiring thorough disclosure and the conspicuous notice to the unwary customer of the quid pro quo nature of the relationship between the insurance company and its DRP shop. Our calculations estimate that the total cost to consumers in Oregon from the unethical and possibly illegal patterns and practices of various insurers, from which the programs mentioned here are at least partially responsible, is in the neighborhood of $180 million a year in Oregon alone. Poor repairs, kickbacks, arbitrary denial of portions of claims, and ignoring claim provisions result in a current situation affecting the safety and pocketbooks of all Oregonians. Chairman Metzger and members of the committee, to sum up, I'm sure you've heard the saying, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. In my experience, that quite accurately describes the situation we have in Oregon regarding insurance companies and the power they have to influence something so vital and so important as restoring our damaged vehicles to their original safeties after an accident. It is time that the pendulum swung back in favor of the consumer. Although much more work needs to occur on behalf of Oregonians on this issue, your support of Senate Bill 210 and your efforts to bring it to the governor for his signature are a very good start and a signal to all Oregonians that government is looking out for your best interests. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Hansen. Questions for Mr. Hansen?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Monasanti.
I'm not sure I really understand the issue, and I need a little more explanation. You're saying that insurance companies have certain repair shops that they say you need to go to if you have your car damaged. Is that number one?
I think I wouldn't say you need to go to. It's more of a heavy persuasion.
Heavy persuasion.
Yes.
And this bill requires a sign, and I'm not sure why the sign is going to make a difference to the consumer.
I think because the consumer will at least know that this shop has a written contract with an insurance company of some sort that may put the insurance company and the body shop's interests ahead of theirs. It's a beginning. It's a start. Okay. It's a small start.
And I follow. I'll just respond that if I get I'm one of these people that who gets their car damaged. I won't really know whether that shop. I mean, I won't really care. Maybe.
I think it's different for everybody.
Piece to those of us that carry insurance that. There's some hanky-panky going on.
Well, I think it should be a lot stronger than it is worded now, but, I mean, it's a beginning. Hmm.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Decker.
Well, thank you. So what should we do? I mean, I've been a customer of Cadell's. Are you from Cadell's?
No.
You're not from Cadell's. You're from Cadell's. So what should I've been a customer, I don't know what that a sign would help, a satisfied customer, very satisfied customer. But what is your recommendation? You said this is a small start, and I guess I would, on Senator Moses Anderson's question, I just don't know what a sign is going to do, if that would affect behavioral change that you're hoping for. What would be the solution that if you lived in the world that you wanted to live in, you would recommend?
Well, I think, I mean, there's so much that goes into this. I mean, part of it is truthfulness in the way the insurance companies deal with the customer and the body shops, and full disclosure. There's so much hidden agendas that are going on behind the consumer's back that they have no idea what's going on in their car.
Well, such as, we don't know. I mean, we're consumers, we don't know what these hidden agendas are.
Well, I'll give you a real small example. This was with a Geico claim where the Geico told them that they were going to put on aftermarket parts on the car that were not certified, which is against the law in the state of Oregon. And we brought it to the Geico's attention and said, look, you know, this is against the law. You can't do that. They said, we're going to do it anyway. And we're telling the customer if they want to put the OEM parts in there, they're going to have to pay extra. So we took this to court, and the judge threw the book at Geico and said, you can't make a customer pay extra when the law is it says that you have to put the right parts on the car. You can't make the customer pay extra to when the law is protecting the customer, and made Geico take care of this. But this goes on every day. I mean, there are thousands of claims out there, and you know it's a $400 million industry here in Oregon alone, and this type of behavior is going on because there's nobody out there as an overseer. And I'm not advocating for heavy regulation, but when you have cars that are flying down I-5 here that are doing 70, 80 miles an hour that don't have the frame rails welded on right, and they hit a bump and suspension cattywamps and they go sideways across it and hit the car coming the other way or something, you know, there's a problem. And I mean, it's a big issue.
So, Mr. Chair,
yes. Go ahead.
So you say every day, and I mean, we're just trying to get a sense of the scope of the problem and the scope of, and you have knowledge that we don't have. Mm-hmm. Out of 100 cars that are in your shop, how many would you say are rebuilt or have products in them that you feel were not the prescribed or what the consumer, what the driver thought they were getting when they pick up the car and pick up the keys and pay the bill?
Okay, I'm gonna, this is real rough here, but I'm gonna say out of 100 cars that come into our shop for repairs from an accident, a fresh accident, I would say that probably 30% to 40% have had repairs done at a prior time. And of those that had a structural repair, meaning a heavy accident where there were safety items that had to be repaired, 90% of them need to be re-repaired.
Questions?
So, Mr. Chair.
Senator Monarch Sanders.
It doesn't look like, I mean, a sign will make a difference. To me, it seems like there should be more transparency in what insurances will cover, and if one repair shop charges more than another, to me it makes more sense that insurance companies would let the consumer go wherever they want, but put a cap on how much they would repair, because obviously the insurance companies want to save money, and obviously there's a broad difference amongst repair shops on the quality of work as well as the charges. Does that make sense or not?
Yeah, well, absolutely. And actually, there already is a cap imposed on us by the insurance industry. In Portland, Oregon, it's $42 an hour. That's our rate. And then what we use is we use a database book that's written by a third party that the insurance company and us use, both that set the times. And then the paint rate for materials is $24 an hour. Everybody charges that. Some people may charge a little bit less, but there's a cap on all rates. And so we all work within these caps to begin with. And we use a third-party database to determine how much it's going to cost as far as an allotment of time. The difference is that the insurance companies take those databases, and the database will say, well, to properly put on a frame rail, is the total time is 40 hours. To do everything. And the insurance company will turn around to one of their DRP shops and say, you know, if you're going to be part of this program, you can't charge for all 40 hours. You can only charge for 30. Well, at that point, you get what you pay for. And the technician that's doing the repair, he's only going to get paid 30 hours to do a 40-hour job. He's going to start cutting corners somewhere. So this vicious circle goes around and around, and this is why we see this 90% rate in our shops, because insurance companies will get kickbacks from the body shops in the form of discounts one way or another in exchange for the referrals. But the technicians can't do a proper job if they're not getting paid to do a proper job. You just don't get anything for free.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Decker.
You know, I hate to end. We're ignoring our two other witnesses here, and I apologize. So jump in if. But it seems to me the solution is more transparency so the consumer knows. I mean, my only interest is that the consumer know exactly what they're getting mm-hmm. when they pick up the car. And so I'm disturbed, and probably all of us are, by the statistics that you provided of your experience. I know it was just rough ballpark estimates. So I would like, I mean, my solution would be I'd like something that said, here to the consumer is what was done to your car in those 60 to 70% of cases out of 100 cars that you listed that it did not occur. And so I don't know what that amendment looks like, but that to me is what we would probably, what the consumer would most want is just to know that if they're driving down I-5 at 70 miles an hour, that the work that was done on their car was the work that they agreed to and signed off to. And your testimony is that oftentimes it's not, or at certain times it's not.
Yeah, the problem is that you'd have to have it's the fox watching the hen house. You'd have to have a third party signing off on the repair and telling the consumer that this repair was a good repair.
Well, we look to you at the body shops to tell us that.
Yeah, but you see, this is where, and you'll hear testimony from people that have had bad experiences stepping up here in a minute, where the body shop and I believe you have affidavits in your file there of customers and people have come to us where the body shop and the insurance company, after they complained about this not being right, the body shop and the insurance company ganged up on the customer and says, hey, there's nothing wrong with your repair. Take it down the road. It's a good repair. And only when they brought it to somebody who knew what they were looking for and wasn't scared of the insurance company, which was us, what did the insurance company come back and say, you know what, you're right, this is a bad repair, we're totaling it. And this happens all the time. This is, and so when you have the foxes watching the hen house, of course they're going to say it's a good repair. Just get on down the road. I mean, we have one person who couldn't even trade the car in after this is just recent, after he got the car repaired, and the all three dealerships said, no way, this thing has been wrecked and it's not repaired right. We won't even take it in as a trade-in at any cost. We won't touch the car. He took it back to the insurance company. The insurance company and us went over it together. They agreed with us that it was poorly repaired. They turned around to the body shop and said, don't worry about it. Don't fix it. That's $8,000 re-repair. This goes on all the time. This is not a one... I mean... And because of our stand and our advertising, we're kind of a magnet for people that have had problems with other body shops. And so we see this, you know, day in and day out. And I would venture to say right now that we're probably having a car every 2 weeks is being totaled in our shop from another shop. And the rest of them that come in for re-repairs are being repaired again. It's a huge problem.
Okay, let's move on. Mr. Lenko, go ahead, please.
Oh, yes, of course. Senator, Chair, and the committee, I want to kind of read my statement also here, and I'll be more than happy to ask questions. This is, I think, Mr. Hansen has just touched the surface on this whole problem. First, let me give you a brief history of my involvement in the collision repair industry and therefore the relevancy of my testimony here. I've been involved in the auto repair industry and the collision repair industry for most of my life. For the past 31 years, I have owned and operated an independent collision repair facility. I've been an active member of ASA, the Auto Body Craftsman Association, and the newly formed NADA for most of those 31 years. When I heard of Senate Bill 210 being introduced requiring all DRP repair facilities to post a sign reading, this repair shop has an agreement to provide an insurance company with discounted prices or a limit on the scope of work provided in exchange for the insurance company referring work to this shop, I felt that it was a very truthful statement because that's exactly what the insurance companies are asking them to do. Discount their door rates, use cheaper aftermarket parts, and not get paid for some of the repair procedures needed to do the repairs properly. All of these things are being done in exchange for them referring work to the repair shops, and my question would be, is that construed as work direction? I think that's another issue again. We as the premier collision repair facility in our area have chose not to be involved in these direct repair programs after looking at most of them. The reason being, we feel it's a huge disservice to the consumer due to the seemingly loss of choice where the vehicles are repaired, the loss of value, and generally speaking, a lack of quality in the whole repair process. These kinds of arrangements also set up an atmosphere in which I see many shops overbilling in other areas to make up the profit difference to stay in business. We have documentation which the DRP repair facility, using their discounted labor rates with the use of cheaper aftermarket parts, has a higher repair cost estimate than our final bill would be using our posted door rates, which are higher than the discounted rates, using the original equipment manufacturer's parts in the job, and we end up with a lower bill, and the reason is they're overcharging for procedures or billing for parts they're not using in the job. The proposed new language is way too vague and watered down. As most of us know, the preferred provider in the healthcare industry does not necessarily bring better service to the public. I don't think that healthcare providers rely on the insurance companies for referrals. That choice is left up to the individual, not the company paying the claim. In closing, let me say that in the best interest of the consumer, I support Bill 210 in its original format and language. This repair shop has an agreement to provide an insurance company with discounted price or limit on the scope of the work provided in exchange for an insurance company for bringing work to the shop. I also have a copy of a letter sent from one of the I don't have that listed in here. I have a copy of a letter sent from one of the DRP direct managers to their shops stating that if this bill passed in this form, that it would be detrimental to their business. Now, I think that the consumer really needs to be aware of what the agreements are between the shops and the insurance companies so that they can make a qualified choice as to how to have their car repaired and who to have it repaired by. And I think that signage, Senator Anderson pointed out, is that doesn't seem to be a big deal, but it's a start. At least the consumer will be aware that there's an agreement. Now they're not aware. They're asked to go to a repair shop because they think they're going to get better service and the insurance company is going to save money and all the things. And unfortunately, in most cases, that's an untrue statement. Thank you. Please.
Good afternoon. I'm Don Braden. I'm the Chief Operating Officer at Cadell's Auto Body. We operate 9 auto body repair facilities in Oregon. We've been in business since 1954. One of the pillars of our marketing strategy is to create an experience that will ensure our return customer. And we focus on return customers. An important part of this strategy is the direct repair programs that we have with insurance companies. We're willing to live with the revised language in the statute. We, however, do believe that in fairness to the consumer, the locations that do not have preferred provider agreements with insurance companies should disclose the lack of the relationship to the consumer and explain the impact on the consumer of the lack of the relationship. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions for these other gentlemen? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now, we're running on the clocks, but what I'm going to do is, first of all, refer the members to the material that they have. And we have testimony, written testimony, from Mr. Ron Davies and Miguel Ramos about their personal experiences. And I'm going to ask them to come forward if they're here. But I think we've looked at it, but we're all going to read the your examples, and I already have. But in the interest of time, I'm just going to ask you to talk, since we have the written testimony, about the bill that's before us. We've seen your experiences that you have had. And please kind of narrow to that as to what you think this legislation would do based on the experience that you have submitted for us. So please, I'll start with you, sir.
Okay, my name is Ron Davies. And Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today. I am here today in support of Senate Bill 210. In my specific case, after a motor vehicle accident, I took my car to a preferred provider, auto repair shop, on the advice of my insurer. After my car was returned to me, I immediately noticed several serious errors and problems that were persisting with the vehicle. I complained to the repair shop and to the insurer, but was told that the car repairs were all done properly and within specifications. It was not until I took my repaired vehicle to an independent repair shop that I received a fair and satisfactory settlement. Upfront disclosure of these direct repair problems would be a benefit to consumers like myself. And in my opinion, the most important information and the more information available to the people like myself, the better. Most of us are ill-equipped to battle insurance companies. Informing more Oregonians that they have the right to get an independent analysis can only lead to fewer problems for everyone. I urge your support of Senate Bill 210 in the strongest form possible. And thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Davies. Mr. Ramos.
I want to thank for the opportunity to be here today. For the record, Mr. Chair Metzger and members of the committee, my name is Miguel Ramos, and I appreciate the opportunity to share the with the committee my experience as a consumer as it relates to the auto repair industry. The point is, without the independent analysis, I would have been deprived my rights under my own policy, lost potential compensation for my loss, and more critically, forced to drive a vehicle that was unsafe at any speed. As it stands today, I am still awaiting compensation from my from my insurer for the loss I have suffered. I am supportive of Senate Bill 210 and urge the committee to support its passage in the strongest form possible. In conclusion, Senate Bill 210 is good for consumers. It is preferable to have as much information as possible as one seeks to recover insured losses and certainly make critical decisions in the marketplace. It would have made a big difference in my case, saving me considerable time and money. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. Questions for either of our...
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Decker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm just debating these Dash 1 amendments, which I know this is kind of legislature speak, but I'm putting myself in your shoes. If you walk into a shop, and thank you obviously for coming down and taking time out of your day, and we haven't heard from the insurance companies, and we need to do that, but I'm putting myself in your shoes. If you saw a sign that said, this repair shop has a preferred provider agreement with the following insurance companies, would that give you any information that is relevant to you? And that's what the Dash 1 amendments, which I find myself not supporting, would that give you any information that you could use if you saw a sign that said that?
It would have given me the opportunity to ask more questions, because that's one of the things that I didn't know what kind of relationship they had. It was very difficult for me to get any information on what kind of relationship that this specific auto body had with my insurance. And when I tried to move my car, they made it very difficult for me to do that. And so if in my case, if I would have seen some kind of signage saying that they are a preferred provider and my insurance name came on it, then I would have asked more questions that would have given me the opportunity to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And my feeling is, as you've heard from others too, is that it's a start. In my particular case, it took many months, and I had problems ongoing until I got this independent repair shop involved. When they got involved, things happened very quickly. But when I was working with this quote-unquote preferred provider, it drug on for months, and I literally didn't have use of my vehicle during that period of time.
My thought, Mr. Chair, is just that you would go with at least something similar. This might be loaded, the original language, but it says, and that to me is more in understandable terms for consumers and for citizens, is this repair shop has an agreement to provide an insurance company with discounted prices on limited or a limited on the scope of work performed in exchange. Well, and we probably need to tweak that language, because that's kind of loaded, in exchange for the insurance companies referring work to this repair shop. But that, to me, is language that actually, if you walked out here and you grabbed 10 people,
right,
they actually understand what that means.
In fact, the original language, candidly, I thought was better written than the revised version, mm-hmm. because the original language I thought was clearer, as you mentioned, and if that could be adopted, I think it would be a stronger bill. I agree.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Any other questions? That's a very good observation, Senator Decker. I'll take that. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Mr. Miller, you're a professional lobbyist, so you know when I tell you I'm going to give you about 2 minutes here for now. You're the last one signed up.
He represents the insurance guys.
Yeah. Mr.
Welcome.
Chairman, members of the committee, Sean Miller, I represent the Property and Casualty Insurers Association. Here today in opposition to Senate Bill 210, I think with just some modifications to the Dash 1 amendments and my conversations with Mr. Neely, can quickly change to a neutral position. I think I do want to state, though, for the record, the opposition to Senate Bill 210 deals with the language of the definition of preferred provider agreement, and the extension of the language within the sign. What you're saying here, and again, I represent hundreds of companies doing business in Oregon. Every one of these agreements is differently, and I can tell you they're not going to fall under this particular definition. in which case the intent of the Attorney General is to actually put up the sign. Many of these repair shops are not even going to have to put up the sign, because a lot of these agreements are timeliness for the consumer, quality of work, issues like that. I think what you just heard from the last folks that testified was, if you do put the sign up, which we would be okay with, it gives them the ability to ask the questions, what are the agreements with the companies, and let the consumer decide whether they go to that company or another repair shop. Again, what the committee needs to know is they do have that choice. They can go to one that has the preferred agreement or the one that doesn't. And so, again, we would support the Dash 1 amendment. However, lines 27 through 29, when it talks about the definition of preferred provider agreements, the limitation on the scope of work, that is implying that an insurance company has an agreement with a repair shop not to do the work that they're supposed to do for the consumer. And that is simply not the case, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. And therefore, I think the definition, we would support taking that definition out. And again, though, still providing the signage, because again, the consumer understanding the sign and being able to ask that question, I don't think is anything we have a problem with. And again, we can have that discussion with Mr. Neely and the committee, and we'd be happy to work with them.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. Questions for Mr. Miller?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Deckert.
Sorry to monopolize on
this. No, you're not at all.
Sean, and I understand if you can't answer this question or take a position, but how about this repair shop has an agreement to provide an insurance company with discounted prices, period. And that's what the sign says. It's one sentence long.
Mr. Chair, Senator Deckert, I'd have to go back and again, with hundreds of companies that might not have anything like that in their agreement, that repair shop would not have to post a sign. And so without understanding all the dynamics within all of these agreements, which everyone's different, I think what the Attorney General's office's intent is just giving the consumer the ability to say, hey, what is the agreement? And whether it's quality of work, it's timeliness, there's issues that are the standards that the repair shop is meeting for the insurance company, they can say, hey, that's a good, or they can look at some of these other agreements and make that decision. I can't answer that today, but I'd be happy to pose that question. I just don't know if that, being that specific, will work for the intent of the bill.
So my two cents is just that it just be under, I don't find the amended language, the dash ones, as common citizen is going to understand that. So I would just, my two cents would be trying to find that language that people actually know what and how big the sign is so that they could actually see it.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Deckert. I think what this is a very it's an interesting issue, and we've talked about it a little bit before coming into hearing over the last few weeks as we've been scheduling these bills. And, I think it is a very, very important consumer issue. I think any time we provide knowledge to the consumer, we benefit. I think some of the points that were brought up are very valid. Senator Deckert, actually, I share your thoughts about the Dash 1, and to me it tells me nothing. My mother would look at that thinking, oh, preferred provider, that means everybody thinks they're the best thing since sliced bread. I mean, she'd have a totally different opinion of that than maybe someone else might. And so I think in terms of trying to get to the type of language that the average consumer would understand is sufficient enough to propel them to the next step, which is, what does this mean? I think we need a little, I think the Attorney General's the Dash 1 is, basically doesn't tell me anything, and the other one really is accusatory. I think there is something in between there that provides the right kind of information that will prompt the consumer to go the next step. I know the committee is very interested in doing something with this bill. So we will work on that language that is fair and also informative, as Senator Deckard pointed out, so that people understand it, and then we will bring it back. We do not have time today for Senate Bill 585, but we will schedule that as soon as possible, because the other committee is coming in. Thank all of you for taking time to come. It's been a very interesting hearing. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 210. Adjourn the committee, and remember, tomorrow we'll be in Hood River. Senator Montes Anderson and Senator Sarin are traveling together. Senator Deckert is going to journey to Hood River on his own.
Am I?
Well, that's what I heard. I heard you were driving on your own, but you're welcome to ride it with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.